The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Navigating Narcolepsy in Family Practice, Patient-Centered Strategies to Optimize the Experience and Outcomes of Treatment. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/UVZ860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello, I'm Dr. Richard Bogan. I'm the Associate Clinical Professor at the Medical University of South Carolina, Charleston, and University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia, and Principal Bogan Sleep Consultants in Columbia. I want to welcome you to this educational activity on recognizing and managing narcolepsy in the primary care setting. Our goals for today: improve the ability to identify patients whose symptoms suggest narcolepsy. We have a lot of sleepy patients in our clinic. Which ones have narcolepsy? Recognize the pervasive ripple effect that disrupted nocturnal sleep has on patients' overall health and quality of life. Understand how burdens of treatment, including dosing schedules, undermine optimal adherence. How do we pick which therapy and what do we expect? Tailor narcolepsy treatment plans to the needs of each individual patient. As we know, sleepiness is pervasive in a primary care practice, and probably about 30% of your patients are sleepy. We know sleep is a fundamental homeostatic drive, just like hydration and eating. What we know is that when individuals are deprived of sleep, obviously they're sleepy, but they also have fatigue. Sleepy people are tired, have executive function abnormalities, speed of processing, memory loss. Of course, they can have mood changes, low productivity, low social interaction. And of course, fatigue-related accidents can occur. And there can actually be changes in the immune system and autonomic tone. All of these tell us that sleep is fundamentally important. We actually have photoreceptors in our eyes that talk to a clock right behind the suprachiasmatic nucleus, and the clock sends a signal, interesting, via the superior cervical ganglion up to the pineal gland. And when the clock is active, it's inhibiting melatonin production, and the clock is actually hardwired to the hypothalamus, to an area deep in the middle of the dorsolateral hypothalamus, and activates a small group of neurons that make a neuropeptide, orexin. And that neuropeptide then branches out to subcenters in the brain that excite other neurotransmitters, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, histamine, acetylcholine. All of this is creating state stability and exciting the brain. So the clock is doing this and inhibiting melatonin. The signal, when the sun sets, those photoreceptors pick it up. There's less output from the clock. The pineal gland begins to make melatonin. And ultimately, the melatonin levels rise and turn the clock off, and we go to sleep. So the circadian rhythm actually controls many of our biological processes. It's ubiquitous in living organisms, and it affects core body temperature, blood pressure, hormone secretion, immune response, and of course the sleep-wake cycle as we talked about it. Now I mentioned orexin. The other name for orexin is hypocretin. So hypocretin, as you can see, stimulates all these other neurotransmitters and we are awake. And those neurotransmitters, particularly norepinephrine and serotonin, inhibit the sleep circuit. There's a sleep group of neurons called the ventrolateral preoptic area that makes a neurotransmitter GABA. And with less output from the awake circuits, the sleep circuits light up and they make GABA and turn off these hypocretin and alerting neurons. And we then go into a state of sleep. And then when we sleep, we actually sleep in 90-minute cycles. So we go down deep, and then we have a period of dreaming, and then most of us wake up, turn over, go back to sleep. We don't remember that. So when we look at sleep-wake processes, and this graph, you can see the normal person has state stability. They have this wake period when the suprachiasmatic nucleus, and we're making orexin and dopamine and norepinephrine and all those. And then when we sleep, we have this ultradian rhythm. You can see it's very nicely organized. We have this deep, slow-wave sleep. The brain actually shrinks and drains off cerebrospinal fluid, and we get rid of a chemical in our brain called adenosine, which is what makes us tired. So this is necessary for us to function. Look at the narcolepsy patient underneath. The narcolepsy patient has state instability. So both sleep and wake are unstable. Certainly in type 1 narcolepsy, there's a deficiency of orexin. We'll talk about this a little bit more later on. But these individuals have low orexin levels. So therefore, the sleep and the dreaming centers in the brain, these are subcortical primitive circuits. The sleep and the dreaming circuits are disinhibited. so they tend to pop in. Now, if you're very active and stimulated, you can suppress those through other pathways. But if you're relatively inactive and you have narcolepsy, then you will quickly fall asleep, and you can see this REM intrusion. We call these sleep onset REM episodes. This is important because we actually use that as a diagnostic tool, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. But think of this state instability and sleepy people, and they also have a lot of REM-related symptoms. So when we think about this lack of orexin and the sleep and dreaming center penetrate, of course, excessive sleepiness. We think about the pentad of narcolepsy. So we have excessive daytime sleepiness, and we can have cataplexy in type 1 narcolepsy. Remember, type 1 clearly has low orexin levels, and because the sleep generator, the REM generator, is overactive and we're paralyzed when we're dreaming, then we can see the REM intrusion into wakefulness. And this is actually prefrontal cortex, amygdala, into the REM generator, and the REM generator pumps in, particularly with strong emotion, laughter being the most common, but it could be fear, anger, surprise. But all of a sudden, the individual says, my muscles feel weak. I feel as though I'm going to melt. The knees are buckled, or the head will get heavy, or they have trouble getting words out, or they may drop things. This is cataplexy. It doesn't last very long. It's about 2 minutes. The person is still awake. If they have complete cataplexy, they're totally paralyzed. They can still breathe, and they're awake. They're aware of the environment. Of course, we can see sleep paralysis, which is a REM dissociative state. So the individual wakes up out of a dream and feels paralyzed briefly. 2/3 of these patients have disrupted nocturnal sleep. They say, I'm busy all night. I'm dreaming a lot and wake up a lot. I think I have insomnia. It's actually narcolepsy because these individuals are sleepy. Insomnia patients can't take a nap. These individuals can take a nap on demand. And of course, if we have REM penetrate into wakefulness, then the individuals can see or hear the dream. And we call these hypnopompic or hypnagogic hallucinations. Again, they don't last long, but it's very disturbing to the patients. And the peak incidence of narcolepsy is around age 15 plus or minus. And oftentimes these adolescents don't really know that this is strange. And even the cataplexy, they don't recognize it. So you have to ask them about it. And sometimes they're quite frankly relieved. So we've taken this pathophysiology and translate that into our nosology. And our nosology says that narcolepsy patients have chronic excessive daytime sleepiness. 3 months is chronic by our definition. And then we do a series of nap studies. Remember the graph of the normal and the narcolepsy patients and the sleepiness and the REM intrusion. So we do nap studies during the day. We put a patient in a dark room, lights out, every 2 hours, typically 9, 11, 1, 3. And we turn the lights out and see what their brain does. And what we see in narcolepsy patients is that they fall asleep fast and they dream. You shouldn't dream in the daytime unless you take a 60-minute nap or so. So they have REM intrusion, and so the mean sleep latency of less than 8 minutes and 2 sleep onset REM episodes is what we do in terms of evaluating these patients. Now, we do a sleep study the night before to make sure there's no other sleep disorder, and we're not measuring insufficient sleep. So if you do a spinal tap on narcolepsy patients and they have no orexin, hypocretin is the other term, then they have cataplexy. Well, they may or may not have cataplexy, but if they have cataplexy or low spinal fluid tap levels of orexin, then that's type 1. Type 2 is just like type 1, except they don't have cataplexy. And if you do a spinal tap on type 2 patients, they'll have normal or low orexin levels, but not very low levels the way type 1 patients are. So that's the differentiating point. So let's look at Kaylee. She's 27 years old, and she says, I've struggled to focus in school and was diagnosed with ADHD, inattention type. Many patients who are sleepy have problems with focus and attention. So we have to make sure when we have a patient with ADHD, we're not dealing with sleepiness. With coaching and methylphenidate, her symptoms improve, and she completed undergraduate and master's degree. The brain is okay. It's just sleepy brain. Kaylee loves her job as a high school guidance counselor, but she constantly feels tired. Her low energy and tendency to space out of work hamper her performance. So she's having executive function, fatigue, sleepiness. And we use the Epworth score. The Epworth score is a quantitative measure of sleepiness. It goes to 24. I'm a 6. 10 or less is normal. And she's a 16, so she's pretty sleepy. So she says, I might need my medicine changed. The point here is that when we see a patient who has sleepiness, fatigue, executive function abnormalities, memory or things of that nature, or mood changes, we need to determine if that individual is sleepy because sleep affects that. And this individual obviously is very sleepy, and we need to explore what's happening. Now, quite frankly, many of the individuals with narcolepsy have a long road to their diagnosis. I mean, the onset of symptoms is right around age 15, but there's a diagnostic delay. So it's very common to see these individuals go for a long time with these symptoms. And oftentimes, the cataplexy gets evaluated for cardiovascular or neurologic or even psychiatric abnormality, which can delay the diagnosis. Does this individual have another reason to be tired or sleepy? Is there an underlying medical or psychiatric problem, or are there medications or drugs that are involved? We do have questionnaires. The Epworth score is the one we rely on. In my clinic, we use fatigue scores and we use functional outcomes of sleep questionnaire to kind of quantify. We have some sleep scales for insomnia to kind of query people. But obviously, we do a sleep study and a multiple sleep latency test. These other tests, the MWT, the maintenance of wakefulness test, and performance testing, those are really research tools. So it's what you do. I mean, you do a history physical. What medicines are you taking? Then when you look at the Epworth scores, 8 simple questions. How likely are you to doze off under these circumstances? And if there's no chance, it's a 0. But if there's a high chance, it's a 3. And 3 times 8 is 24. And you can see most patients with narcolepsy, quite frankly, are very sleepy. And so they're going to be up 16, 18. I've even seen 22 in patients before because they will nod off at any time. Our sleep apnea patients can vary. I mean, you know, some of our sleep apnea patients are tired, but they're not necessarily sleepy. So you can see the Epworth score in sleep apnea patients is lower. So the differential diagnosis, obviously, we want to make sure people get enough sleep. And, you know, what is enough sleep is always a big question in everybody. Some people need 6 hours, some people need 9 hours. And we have criteria in our nosology that says we want the patients to get at least 6 hours. Sleep apnea is very prevalent. People snore, gasp, and choke and disrupt sleep. So even though they might get 8 hours, it's chopped into pieces because of holding their breath. Poor sleep hygiene, stay up late, watch the movies, you know, other things, coffee late. Circadian rhythm abnormality. Delayed sleep phase people can fool us. These are night owls. They love to stay up late and sleep in late, but they have to get up and go to work. So they end up having insufficient sleep or entrainment issues. Idiopathic hypersomnia is a disorder similar to narcolepsy, but it has some differences. They have sleep inertia and take long naps that are not restorative, and they don't typically have the REM dissociative symptoms. And they can sleep long hours. Line 11 is rare, cyclical hypersomnia. And of course, patients can have other sleep disorders, restless leg syndrome, periodic leg movements. And as we talked earlier, we need to look at the underlying medical. Are they diabetic with poor control or hypothyroidism, or do they have underlying significant depression, et cetera? Cataplexy, remember, brief loss of muscle tone. Are they fainting? Do they have a heart arrhythmia? Do they have a seizure, myasthenia gravis? Prader-Willi syndrome is rare. But these are kind of things that we think about, cardiovascular, CNS, or even psychiatric. And of course, the hallucinations, some of the people think they have psychosis and they're afraid to talk about it. So ask them about it. Again, they're short-lived. So let's think about narcolepsy patients. Let's think about normal sleep-wake processes. 30% of your clinic patients are sleepy. You probably got at least 2 narcolepsy patients. When you understand sleep-wake processes and how narcolepsy presents, you can ask the right questions to make a diagnosis. As we pointed out earlier, we have patients with narcolepsy who are excessively sleepy and may or may not have cataplexy, depending on type 1 or type 2. But many of these individuals have disrupted nocturnal sleep. They have state instability. As a result, these individuals have impaired daytime function, and many of the patients actually think they have insomnia because they wake up so much. Because the orexin is necessary for state stability, and orexin, as we said earlier, affects other things, the hypothalamic pituitary axis, it affects the central nervous system in terms of autonomic tone and cardiovascular effects, even gastrointestinal. So orexin is really important. And we're curious about what this does to the general health of these individuals beyond the sleepiness and fatigue and work-related accidents and low productivity. And when you look at claims data in these individuals. Now, this is observational data, but it appears that these individuals do have an elevated risk for cardiovascular and cardiometabolic abnormalities. They tend to have elevated body mass index. And in the pediatric population, we can actually see precocious puberty. So these in the pediatric presentation, these individuals can appear to be hyperactive to some extent, but they're sleepy and they have elevated body mass index and precocious puberty. So remember that in these individuals. And we can see inflammatory inflammatory markers increase. So these individuals have higher healthcare utilizations and other issues that we need to take into account, particularly when we think about how we're going to treat these individuals. Multiple domains are affected by sleep and sleep-wake processes, including emotion. We know 35% plus or minus patients with narcolepsy do have depression, and they have a higher prevalence of attention deficit problems. Is it the sleepiness, or do they have underlying ADHD? We have to keep that in mind. And they have metabolic changes. As I said, they gain weight, and they could have some underlying immune abnormalities. So we want to keep that in mind. And quite frankly, in some of the females, and this has been published by Ohayon, we can see some increase in autoimmune abnormalities, such as rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or other things. So let's look at Gabe, age 49. Gabe was diagnosed with type 2 narcolepsy, which means he doesn't have cataplexy, 4 years ago, and he is being treated with modafinil. Now, he reports that he's feeling more alert during the day, but still has a great deal of trouble getting up in the morning, which we call sleep inertia. So he's often late for work and never feels rested. And of course, I would ask him, what's your drive like to work? Do you have trouble driving? His hemoglobin A1C and BMI have been steadily increasing. Remember, we talked about endocrine changes and obesity and narcolepsy, and they're currently 6.2% and 31 kilograms per meter square, respectively. Now, both of those were under pretty good control when he had more energy and he worked out regularly. But now he complains that he no longer has the energy to go for a run or even a stroll. And oh, by the way, his Epworth score is 14. I think there are several messages here. One is narcolepsy can be very difficult to treat in terms of achieving what the patient's expectations are in terms of fatigue and sleepiness, as well as the disrupted nocturnal sleep. So it's important for us to understand there are other treatment options. And we'll talk about this some more, but modafinil are options. Of course, sometimes we use Schedule 2 stimulants in patients. We have pitolisant that hits histamine. We have solriamfetol, which hits dopamine and norepinephrine. And then we have oxybate molecules as well. The oxybate molecules you take at night, which seems odd, but it seems to inhibit the alerting pathways, stabilize sleep, and then when it wears off, they wake up more easily and the other medications work better. So I think it's important for us to customize the care, ask our patients how they're doing in terms of, again, the fatigue, the sleepiness, the disturbed nocturnal sleep, and then the downstream implications, driving, workplace performance, social interaction. All of those are very important. So what are the most common narcolepsy symptoms after sleepiness and cataplexy? And the sleep state instability is quite prominent. I use the percentage 2/3. I think that's probably true. Depends on what study you read, 30 to 95% of patients complain of their sleep. Interestingly, there's only one question in our validated narcolepsy severity scale, which we use in research, that asks about disturbed nocturnal sleep. We actually use a type of insomnia index, and many times the patients with narcolepsy have an elevated insomnia index score. Now, I'm not saying you should use an insomnia index in narcolepsy, but the point is these individuals do have disrupted nocturnal sleep, and oftentimes right after the sleepiness, that's what they complain about. Doc, I'm busy all night. I'm dreaming. I have this paralysis, which is frightening to me. And oh, by the way, when you're in REM sleep, your carbon dioxide level is about 5 millimeters of mercury higher. So they can wake up paralyzed and say they're smothering or can't breathe. It's quite frightening, particularly if it's associated with an hallucination. These individuals have more state instability. They have more transitions into wakefulness, or the speed of transitioning into REM sleep is quicker. So they have REM intrusion or dissociative states when the brain's in two states at one time. And so there are some significant measurable abnormalities that are not diagnostic, but we can observe. And when we actually treat these individuals, we can see some changes. Now, when we look at this elevated cardiovascular risk in people with narcolepsy, it's probably multifactorial, but it does include disturbed nocturnal sleep. Every time you wake up, you get an increase in sympathetic tone. So heart rate goes up and blood pressure. That's how these electronic wearable devices tell us about our sleep, is monitoring heart rate. So heart rate and blood pressure can go up when we wake up. And also when we have state instability, particularly in narcolepsy, then that can add to it. So when you're asleep, your heart rate drops, blood pressure drops. We call it dipping. And interestingly, patients with narcolepsy have a higher risk of these cardiovascular complications. And quite frankly, many of them don't dip in the night. Their heart rate and blood pressure doesn't particularly dip. So I think it's very important for us to, again, reflect on normal sleep-wake processes, the importance of orexin in creating state stability. There is some sort of orexin signaling abnormality and presumptively in these individuals, and this creates state instability, which can translate into changes in autonomic tone and feeding and other endocrine abnormalities that may contribute to this cardiovascular risk, elevated body mass index, and perhaps glucose intolerance. Patients with narcolepsy have state instability and some increase in cardiovascular risk and obesity and endocrine abnormalities and mood changes. All these things are important for us to consider. And many times the patients will tell you, not only am I sleepy, doc, but I'm tired and I have low motivation. I can't work out. You know, I'm hungry all the time, et cetera. So our big goal, obviously, is to reduce the sleepiness. And I always ask my patients, do you take a nap every day? I ask, do you take a nap? Do you doze off when you're trying to stay awake? Does the sleepiness interfere with your function? Does it keep you from doing things you want to do, either at work, family interaction? Do you have trouble driving? Now, these are things that I use to sort of quantify the degree of sleepiness. And of course, I use the Epworth score. Now, cataplexy, the REM dissociative symptoms, cataplexy can be quite bothersome in these individuals. And oftentimes they recognize either consciously or unconsciously what causes the cataplexy. So they're like, when I'm laughing, I better be sitting down when I'm laughing. Or if someone tells a funny joke, I'll block it to block the cataplexy. Or they avoid social interaction, which is not a good thing. So we need to understand, are you worried about your cataplexy? How does it affect you? And how is our treatment going to affect that? And the two drugs that are currently approved to treat cataplexy are pitolisant and oxybate. Now, we actually off-label use some other medications. Remember, I told you the norepinephrine and serotonin hit the REM generator. And so we've used off-label some SSRIs, SNRIs to maybe reduce cataplexy. But the drugs that are approved by the FDA are actually pitolisant and oxybate, and we'll talk about that. Obviously, then I ask the patients, okay, now that we talked to address the sleepiness and cataplexy, let's talk about your sleep. What's your sleep like? Are you having dreams? Are you having paralysis? Are you having hallucinations? Are you waking up a lot? Is it easy for you to wake up in the morning? And then what happens in the daytime? Are you able to get up and drive to work safely? Is your workplace performance okay? Do you have anything left for the family in terms of social interaction? Have you had any safety issues that are bothering either you personally or other people around you? So these are things that we take into account. Then who are you? What are your comorbidities? What medicines are you taking? And let's customize how we can treat you. Now, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has actually given us some very specific recommendations. There are some registry trials that show that armodafinil, modafinil, have shown some benefit. And of course, we have pitolisant, which hits histamine, and solriamfetol that hits dopamine and norepinephrine. And of course, modafinil, armodafinil probably hit dopamine. Sodium oxybate, you take at night and it inhibits dopamine and norepinephrine, stabilizes sleep. And then when it wears off, those alerting pathways tend to upregulate. So this is what the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has recommended. Sodium oxybate is actually a very interesting molecule. Sodium oxybate is metabolized to gamma-hydroxybutyrate. Your brain actually makes gamma-hydroxybutyrate. Remember, we talked about GABA, and GABA probably is either directly or indirectly metabolized to gamma-hydroxybutyrate. It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. And as I said, it inhibits dopamine. And as a result, when it wears off in the night, the patients tell us, I don't dream as much. My sleep is better. It's deeper sleep. And we actually have polysomnographic studies that show an increase in slow wave sleep and less state transition. So I ask my patients, how quickly do you fall asleep? And then what happens to the REM dissociation? Associative symptoms, how easy it is for you to wake up in the morning. Then we talk about all those sleepiness and workplace performance issues, et cetera. So this is really interesting because the classic form of sodium oxybate is a liquid. So you draw it up in a syringe, put it in a vial, and add water to it. And the immediate release formulation, you have to take two doses. It has a very short half-life and only lasts about 4 hours. But when you get up to the doses, we start low dose and work our way up. Or a response, then we're talking about over 1 gram of salt and maybe up to 1.6 grams of sodium load, which is worrisome, particularly if these individuals have higher risk for hypertension and cardiovascular comorbidities. We know if you reduce sodium intake by 1,000 milligrams, you know, we can probably see a signal in blood pressure and other things. Now, there's a formulation with 92% less sodium that's been approved by the FDA. It's also a liquid, short half-life. And now we have a molecule that is a sustained release. And so it's only once a night dosing of sodium oxybate. So therefore, this particular molecule has an advantage in that it's a once nightly formula that was approved by the FDA in 2023. So we have three oxybate molecules, immediate release sodium oxybate, lower sodium oxybate, or low sodium oxybate, and now once nightly formulations. Quite frankly, the effect size of this is quite high. You can see how GABA is very important as an inhibitory. And we have actually multiple GABA-A receptors in our brain that affect sleep and memory and seizure activity, et cetera. But there are GABA-A receptors, and there are also GABA-B receptors. And we think that, as I said, your brain actually makes gamma-hydroxybutyrate. It's not actually sodium oxybate in the brain in the perisynaptic space. It's gamma hydroxybutyrate, and it binds to these GHB receptors or GABA-B receptors, so it's inhibitory, mainly hitting dopamine, norepinephrine, and thalamocortical neurons, so it stabilizes sleep. And we don't know the exact mechanism of action, but this is what happens in rodents. And we extrapolate that over to humans because we know this molecule is metabolized through the Krebs cycle to carbon dioxide and water. So we have a patient, Ariana, age 34. Ariana is a stay-at-home mom of three. She has a 13-year history of type 1 narcolepsy. So if you do the math, she was age 21, which is kind of typical for age of onset, maybe earlier. Her longtime regimen was sodium oxybate, plus, remember, solriamfetol, dopamine, norepinephrine. It's generally been working pretty well for her. On occasion, she has taken her second dose late, which leaves her sluggish. So remember, the concentration of the immediate release peaks right close to an hour, plus or minus, and the half-life is only about an hour. And so it only lasts 4 hours. So the patients typically set an alarm for 4 hours, and then they wake up, drink the second dose, or some of them wake up spontaneously. But the issue is if you take it late, then 4 hours later, 3 hours later, if you have to get up, that's an issue. Husband's an accountant. He works long hours during the tax season, and she worries about him waking up when she takes her second dose. So sometimes she skips it accidentally on purpose. And, you know, our patients are always kind of customizing when they go to sleep and when they wake up. So depending upon the patient, we can consider. Now we have three different oxybate molecules. We have the immediate release sodium, which remember at the highest dose could be up to 1.6 grams of sodium load. Then now the low sodium, which is 92% less. And then we have the once nightly. And so we talk to our patients in terms of lifestyle. You have to wake up in the middle of the night to take care of people or not. I mean, are you a single parent? All these things we take into consideration as to when, where, and how to treat the patients. Now, this once nightly molecule is fairly new. As I said, it was approved by the FDA in 2023. So I thought I would explore some of the efficacy data. The REST-ON trial, which is a phase 3 trial, was a 13-week double-blind randomized controlled trial. These individuals did have placebo control 1-to-1. They started at 4.5 grams, which is what we do in the immediate release. And then it's a fixed dose, so it's 4.5 grams for the first week. And then we go to 6 grams for a week. And then you can go to 7.5 grams. So we usually adjust it by 1.5 grams. This is a powder, so you just open up the sachet and put it in a container, add some water to it and shake it up and drink it, and then add a little more water and get that last little bit of powder, and then go to bed. We tell people to take it in the bed because it's fairly rapidly absorbed, and the powder is sort of microencapsulated, so it sort of dissolves at different rates in these individuals, so you only have to take it one time. So how do we tell whether it works or not? We ask our patients, are you sleepy? What's your Epworth score? And then we did the maintenance of wakefulness test, which is just like the MSLT. The only difference is now the patient's in a dark room sitting up and they're trying to stay awake. So you have a sleepy patient who's sitting in a dark room, no sound activity, you know, just keep your eyes open, try to stay awake. So we call that the maintenance of wakefulness test. It's useful because of the floor effect. I mean, you sometimes see people are so sleepy that they fall asleep so fast, it's hard to budge that. So the MWT gives us a little bit different signal. And then we ask them, how do you feel? Talk to me about your narcolepsy. How sleepy are you? What's happening to your REM dissociative symptoms? Are you having cataplexy? And how often are you having cataplexy? And these are endpoints that we looked at in these individuals with narcolepsy. And some were type 1, some were type 2. And then when we look at the Restone results, what happened to the MWT compared to the placebo? And what you see is these individuals can stay awake longer. Now, this is group data, and so there's some outliers, but you can see that when you statistically compare the MWT to the placebo group, there's a signal. These individuals can stay awake longer. And then as clinicians, when we talk to our patients, how are you feeling? The clinical global impression, blinded. We didn't know whether they're taking placebo or drug. We thought we could see a signal at 6 grams, 7.5, and 9 grams that separated these individuals. Now, clinically, we start at the 4.5, and then usually I personally go on to the 6, and then I reassess the patient and make a decision about how they're doing. Do we go to the 7.5 or 9 grams? Look at the cataplexy rate. So the frequency of cataplexies is substantially decreasing compared to the placebo group. So there is a placebo signal, but it clearly statistically separates. So we're seeing a biological signal that says these individuals are objectively more alert. Clinically, we thought they're more alert. The cataplexy decreased. And when we ask them to do their Epworth score, which is their subjective sleepiness, you can see a signal there. And it's a big signal. The 6.52 drop in the Epworth score at 9 grams compared to the placebo group is what we call a significant effect size. For these individuals had a substantial improvement biologically. We did a post-hoc analysis, but when you looked at the sleep study in these individuals, and again at week 3 on the 6 grams and week 8 on the 7.5 and week 13 on the 9 grams, what did we see? We saw a signal of improvement in state stability compared to the placebo group. We saw that these individuals had less arousals, less awakenings. They actually had an increase in slow wave sleep or deep sleep. And there was some change in the REM architecture too, the REM latency. The transition from sleep and non-REM sleep into REM sleep was pushed out farther, and there was a slight decrease in REM sleep. When you look at the post-hoc analysis, the change from baseline in sleep quality, when we asked the patients to do a visual analog scale, you can see a response at 6 grams, 7.5, and 9 grams. And there seems to be a dose response relationship. Now, again, this is post-hoc comparing drug to placebo, not to different dose levels. But visually, it looks like there's a quantitative signal. And then when you looked at the change from baseline in the Epworth score, in these individuals, you can see a signal there. Again, at 6 and 7.5 and 9 grams. So in here, we're teasing out the Epworth score at each dose level, which was not the predefined endpoint. So I think the bottom line is that when we talk to our patients, how does the sleepiness and the REM dissociative symptoms and disturbed nocturnal sleep affect you? What do you worry about? How is it affecting you in terms of your sleepiness, the frequency of cataplexy? Are you worried about having cataplexy? Have you had any personal injury from cataplexy, from falling? How does that affect your ability to work or go to school or your social interaction? And are there other issues going on in terms of mood or executive function, memory, things of that nature, and fatigue-related accidents? And then who are you? What are your comorbidities? What current meds? And then we've explored these different medications that we might use in customized therapy. 80% of patients who are on sodium oxybate actually are also taking a wakefulness promoting medication. So it's not all or none. I think this is the big mistake I see is some clinicians and patients say, well, okay, I take this one drug, I can't take anything else. And actually, there actually is a registry looking at narcolepsy patients, and the majority of patients are actually on polypharmacy. So it's important for us to understand the pharmacokinetics of the drug and the pharmacodynamics and the side effect profile in these individuals so that we can customize. And then we have to take into account the common comorbidities. I mean, these individuals have a higher prevalence of mood disturbance and, as we talked about earlier, obesity and hypertension and diabetes and maybe some other issues, particularly in the females in terms of autoimmune. And so as clinicians, let's talk to our patients and communicate so that they understand what narcolepsy is, how it affects them, strategic naps, behavior. The best thing for sleepiness is sleep. So we have to remind our narcolepsy patients to have a very regular sleep-wake pattern. And, you know, sometimes it's going to be disrupted, but as a rule, we want to try to make sure our patients have a very good sleep-wake process and respect that. This voice of the patient gives us some insight. In 2013, the FDA asked these individuals, tell me about your symptoms and tell me about the medicines and how well they work. And sleepiness obviously was most frequently mentioned, and the burden of fatigue and loss of energy. But their other complaint was insomnia, fractured sleep. problems staying asleep, what they consider chronic sleep deprivation. Now, we know from polysomnographic measurements that these individuals are getting more than 45 minutes of sleep. So I ask patients about time in bed, what time do they go to bed and what time they get up. And I also ask them, how much sleep do you think you're getting? Because that is a valuable signal, particularly if we use oxybate in these patients, and they'll tell us that the quality and continuity of sleep is improved. Now, we talked about the non-pharmacologic approaches in these individuals. Schedule naps, watch your diet, exercise, pay attention to the things more than you normally would in these individuals. And of course, almost all the patients need to take medication. The medications can drastically improve their symptoms. And then what are the side effects? The side effects, these are CNS-active drugs. So again, we always look for headache, dizzy, nausea, anxiety. But we're trying to see if we can improve the sleepiness and, as a result, executive function, motivation, mood, productivity, fatigue-related accidents. We keep all those in mind. There actually was a study done talking to the patients about oxybate therapy and their preferences. But if you took 75 adults who were on immediate-release oxybate therapy or been on it in the past, and you asked them, what would you like to do? What would you prefer overall? Which are you most likely to take exactly as directed? In other words, not skip a dose. And which do you expect would involve less anxiety and stress when you think about having to wake up 4 hours later to take a drug? And if you look at the patients in terms of side effects and preference, the patients had a significant preference for the once nightly dosing, which is not surprising. And then if you think about patient identified burdens of oxybate therapy, and you can see on the graph here, the patients would like to take fewer doses, but you can see that sometimes I miss my second dose and I'm worried about my risk of falling. As you go down this list, these are things that we talk to our patients about. I ask them, you know, if they're taking immediate release, how easy is it for you to wake up and take that second dose? And what effect does it have? And how easy is it for you to wake up in the morning? And do you have to get up and go to the bathroom? Are you wobbly? And we always talk about oversedation and fall prevention in our patients. So these are some of their concerns. One of the advantages of the immediate release is that we can customize the dose. If you know the pharmacokinetics, the nonlinear pharmacokinetics, you can do that. But clearly the patients like the idea of taking one dose. Now, the RESTORE results, this is a patient preference and dosing schedules. So this was, again, open label phase 3 study evaluating the safety and tolerability of once night sodium oxybate and looking at the patient preferences in these individuals. And so you had type 1 or type 2 who completed the REST-ON study. Remember, that was the pivotal trial, placebo-controlled, and on this once nightly oxybate. Or they were receiving a stable dose of twice nightly, or they were sodium oxybate naive. And on this, 94% of the participants preferred the once nightly, which is, again, not surprising. And 65% of the switch patients had missed the second dose in the previous 3 months. So here we have Michael. He's 61. He has type 1 narcolepsy, which was diagnosed after 2 incidents in which he lost control of his car while driving. This is not uncommon. There is an increased prevalence of sleep apnea in narcolepsy patients. We know that about 25% of patients with narcolepsy eventually develop sleep apnea. So he's on CPAP, and he's been prescribed sodium oxybate, but he doesn't take it because he figured the CPAP was enough to improve his sleep at night. So again, patients oftentimes think one treatment is enough. It's not contraindicated in sleep apnea, but we do want you to use your CPAP because it does affect the arousal threshold. Doesn't necessarily make the sleep apnea worse, but for the brain to wake up and start breathing again, it may hold the breath a little bit longer. But I think it's important for us to say, okay, this can cause respiratory depression, but use your CPAP, and we can initiate oxybate therapy in this individual. So I think there are a number of take-home points from this discussion in general is that narcolepsy is so under-recognized. Remember, and I get it, 30% of your patients are sleepy and you only have 2 narcolepsy patients. So it can be tough to find them. And oh, by the way, they present in all kinds of ways, attention problems, mood disturbance, cognitive changes. So they get treated for depression and ADHD and other things before it's figured out that they have narcolepsy. And they have disturbed nocturnal sleep. So some of them present as insomnia. I had a school teacher who said, Doc, I have insomnia, but she taught elementary school. So she looked forward to the kids having their own reading time because she'd put her head down and take a 30-minute nap while the kids were reading independently. Insomnia patients can't nap like that. They're stuck on wake. So this disturbed nocturnal sleep with a high Epworth score, something else is going on. It could be narcolepsy. Ask about the dreams. And though it's not curable, we have lots of treatments. We reviewed those. So the stimulants, pitolisant, solriamfetol, modafinil, armodafinil, and oxybate. And the effect size of oxybate, we explored that. And while some of these medications do have drawbacks, we talked about the headache, dizzy, nausea, anxiety. Many of these patients respond beautifully to the therapy. And again, polypharmacy oftentimes is necessary. It's difficult to get these patients to a level of alertness that is comfortable for them. And again, understanding the medicines, understanding polypharmacy, I think is really important. So in closing, I would like to say the intent was for us to examine sleep-wake processes, how the brain controls sleep and wake, the importance of orexin as that neuropeptide and the clock in the brain, and even melatonin in terms of the circadian rhythm. So we want to explore normal sleep-wake processes and then see what goes wrong in narcolepsy patients with this abnormality in orexin signaling, which creates state instability, and how that translates into the sleepiness and the REM intrusion and the REM dissociative symptoms. So when we talk to our patients, maybe we can say, hey, something is going on here. I need to think about narcolepsy in these individuals, because if I can make that diagnosis, I can have a huge impact in terms of quality of life and productivity and, quite frankly, survival in these individuals. And we talked about all of these take-home points, but importantly, we've got to talk to our patient. I mean, they need to understand narcolepsy as a disorder, the medicines, how they work, and do they want to take medications? What are the side effects? How do they administer them? How many doses do they take? So I think this shared decision-making is really important for our patients, so that our treatment plan really aligns with what the patients need and what are their priorities. So thank you for participating in this educational activity. I hope you found it informative and useful to your practice. Thanks again.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/UVZ860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Avidel CNS Pharmaceuticals, LLC.